Okay, thank you. Actually, I'm stepping in for Arnold Schroeder, who couldn't come to be the experimentalist of the week. So there's actually a subtitle to my talk, and that is something that came across to me recently, namely whether there are some analogies between magnetic quantum phase transitions or materials of magnetic quantum phase transitions and soft matter. So the issue is, and that's my question actually to the theorists, is there some analogy between soft matter and magnetic phase transition? But I'll come to that during the talk. So what one has in magnetic instabilities is a typical transition where by some control parameter such as temperature or pressure, one goes from a magnetic order to a disordered magnetic material, that is a paramagnetic material with fluctuating moments. The thing that is of interest in these quantum phase transitions, of course, is something where, as a function of a control parameter such as fluctuation energies or hybridization, the magnetic moments actually get lost, or in particular metals, they are just ground into the Fermi sea. And the question, I think that is something Mike Norman yesterday explained very nicely, what actually is causing this drowning of the moments in the Fermi sea, and what is actually the exact mechanism? And several scenarios are around for that, that is charge fluctuations, the Conway effect, itinerant magnetism. So I would like to give three examples of magnetic quantum phase transitions. I spend a lot of time on CRM copper 6 that has been doped with gold, that has been around for 15 years now. And I talk about magnetic fluctuations at a quantum critical point as probed by inelastic neutron scattering measurements. And I talk of attempts to determine the band structure of heavy fermions from Hall effect measurements. I'll discuss briefly the anisotropic pressure dependence of magnetic ore that we found recently, and also discuss the issue of pressure versus magnetic field tuning that is related to the question whether there is perhaps a change of the dimensionality of the system. And then I will just briefly discuss a case of a magnetic instability in the presence of very strong magnetic disorder, very strong disorder, and that is this uranium system, where perhaps the quantum phase transition is intercepted by a spinless order. And the credit for this question mark, of course, goes to Peter Young, who yesterday explained nicely what a spinglass is and asked the question whether we do have any evidence for spinglass in these materials. And then I'll come in the final section. I will talk about quantum critical points at a pressure-driven magnetic ferromagnetic instability. And the question mark here arises from the fact whether at this particular system, manganese silicide, the magnetic order actually is close to the vicinity, turns out to be a first order transition. And then I'll briefly discuss this issue I already mentioned. So there have been a number of people involved in this work, and I would like to mention Christian Pfeiffer, Almut Schroeder, and Oliver Stockert. And as you can see from the asterisk, they all have moved to different places, and I'm all by myself again. But of course, we have PhD students, and we have very strong support from other people in neutron scattering. I would like to mention Michael Löwenhaupt, Gabe Apley, Lothar Pinchovius, Dimitri Resnik at some stage. Niels Pücker was also working with us. Then we have a collaboration with the group of Anne de Visser in Amsterdam from Expansion. And with we got samples for uranium, copper, palladium from Biometals group. And we are very fortunate to have very strong collaboration with our theorists in Karlsruhe, Peter Wölfle and his group, Achim Bosch, who has now moved to Cologne with his PhD student, Michael Garst. And also we had a nice collaboration with Piers Coleman and his then PhD student, Ramazat Shirin. Now, the important issues that arise at a magnetic quantum phase transition was actually addressed very nicely yesterday by Mike Norman in his backbone talk. And this is something of a summary of that. Namely, there are two issues. First of all, what actually happens to the Fermi surface at the magnetic instability? And secondly, when you arrive at a magnetic instability, that is where you get to the, you suppress the magnetic order to very low temperatures, then low energy scales, otherwise masked by magnetic interactions, may become important. And that offers the possibility of novel phases. Examples are superconductivity in the vicinity of quantum critical points, or low dimensional fluctuations over an extended concentration range in the cerium copper gold system, or the partial order in manganese silicide. Let me therefore then just jump right into the quantum phase transition cerium copper gold. Cerium copper 6, to remind you, is a heavy fermion system with a very large, roughly 1,000 times larger gamma value than pure copper, so that's of course the sum of their constant. It has a non-magnetic ground state, but it does exhibit short-lived anti-ferromagnetic correlations. What we found a number of years ago is that when you alloy the system with gold, the long-range anti-ferromagnetic order evolves. And that is shown in this view graph here. This is the near temperature, it's anti-ferromagnetic order. The near temperature as a function of gold concentration. At a critical concentration, x equals 0.1, there's an onset of antiferromagnetic order up to this maximum of 2.2 Kelvin for this particular system, cerium copper 5 gold, and that again is a stoichiometric alloy. And I'll explain in a minute why. It's essentially because one particular gold copper side is replaced by gold. And the idea we had early on was that as you expand the lattice by alloying with this larger gold atoms compared to copper, you weaken the hybridization between F electrons and the conduction electrons, and thereby you weaken the Conway effect. And in the simple Doniec picture, then you would strengthen magnetic order, and this negative lattice pressure then explains this onset of magnetic order. And right at this critical concentration, 0.1, we observe non-fermal liquid behavior, that is a gamma coefficient, or C over T, that diverges logarithmically with temperature, a linear resistivity, and a linear dependence of the near temperature on concentration.
At which temperatures did you observe this clock behavior?
It's just shown here. This is C over T, plotted as a function of temperature, and the lowest temperature is something like 50 millikelvin or so. And you can see that this logarithmic temperature dependence here shown in red for the critical concentration actually is observed over 1.5 to 2 orders temperature, magnitude and temperatures. And then, of course, for the pure cerium copper 6 sort of levels off, and then these are the features associated with the magnetic ordering for these concentrations above the critical concentration. The resistivity is rather complicated. It turns out that the resistivity shows an increase at the near temperature for directions, current directions that contain a component of the magnetic ordering wave vector. But as you decrease the concentration, then and you get to again to the critical concentration, you see a linear resistivity in the range of something like 30 millikelvin to 300 millikelvin, again an order of magnitude in temperature.
Do you expect this log behavior up to lowest temperature?
This is
or
something,
no,
we
change to some kind of power law.
This is something we really are trying to investigate right now. We do calibrations going down to something like 15 to 20 millikelvin, check that. Of course, this is motivated by the findings on the Kelvin road to silicon too, where one actually also sees this upturn, that is deviations from this logarithmic behavior. However, one has to bear in mind that in Kelvin mode into silicon two, all the samples that have been investigated, actually, maybe we should close the door. Okay. Oh, that was just a temporary disturbance. Okay, thank you. Anyway, so what I was going to say is that all the ytterbium rhodium silicon to samples that have been investigated and show this upturn actually order magnetically at lower temperatures. And it would be very interesting actually to look at a system that does not, definitely not, order magnetically whether this upturn is still present. I'm not saying it's related to that, but one has to check this question in the same way that we have to check, of course, that we have to go to lower temperatures. Because here you can see this an ordering temperature of 80 millikelvin, and you see this upturn already appearing about at 0.6, 0.7 Kelvin. That is almost a factor of 10 larger.
So this upturn at, say, 0.2, that's because of a magnetic ordering transition, is it?
I don't know what it's due to, but I would assume that it's associated with that, because it's not present in the system where we really have this, we don't have this ordering. But of course, we have to go to low temperatures to actually see what's going on there.
Herbert, it's a very long question. Uh-huh. This component. Could you remind us what is TK? Because I think it's one or two cases in the resistivity when there is really change of behavior.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's much lower than TK. No?
That's of course true. The corner temperature is of the order of 6 Kelvin. And if turbine rhodium to silicon to the corner temperature is larger, and if one then plots the data as T over TK, then of course it is evident that we have to go to lower temperatures. That's why we want to do these experiments.
Mm-hmm. How do you know the TK is?
This is a rough estimate. This is a rough estimate from the specific heat. As it turns out, the specific heat can be described in a single ion condom model, and it scales between 10% and 100% of cerium. And actually, what another thing we want to do, we want to go to lower concentrations to see whether we have this sort of two fluid behavior that has been observed in the 115 compounds that David Pines is advocating.
So is the moment the screen or is it unscreened?
I show you data of the magnetic moment as determined from the neutron scattering. I should also point out that you see that this is not really a dead flat Fermi liquid-like behavior, but there's a slight increase. And there are some experiments that were conducted by Japanese and also at Cornell University. Way down at something like 2 or 3 millikelvin, which would be here in the scale, and there is some evidence of magnetic order, although it's not clear what kind of order that is. It could be nuclear, but could also be electronic. But it's way off the temperature range we are discussing here. Okay, so that's the picture of the structure. The blue balls are the cerium atoms. And these are the red balls are all the copper atoms, and the yellow balls are the sites that are replaced by gold, and that actually would then correspond. And if all these sites are replaced, this stoichiometric alloy compound cerium copper 5, gold 1. So that is these largest copper sites that are replaced by successively when you vary the concentration of gold between 0 and 1. So that is elastic neutron scattering for a sample of 0.2 that is just slightly above the critical concentration. And one sees nice resolution limited Bragg peaks that are incommensurate. And if you plot these data and look in different regions of reciprocal space, you find that all the reflections one sees are confined to the reciprocal A star C star plane, and these are the reflections that are observed for low concentration, and at higher temperatures the reflections jump onto the A axis. And I'll come back to this to this point later. It is important to note that in the following I will show you scans of inelastic neutron scattering along the C star direction for different values of A star. Before I come to that, however, let me briefly remind you what one expects in the spin fluctuation scenario, namely for the specific heat in three dimensions for a ferromagnet, this logarithm behavior. However, we do have, of course, an antiferromagnet. I'll just show you the data where one would expect the square root behavior of the specific heat instead of a divergence. And similarly for the resistivity, we don't see any agreement with our data. So that prompted Achim Rorsch actually to suggest that we might be in a two-dimensional scenario where one has, for an antiferromagnet, indeed a logarithmic temperature dependence of the specific heat and a linear resistivity of a linear temperature dependence of the resistivity. So in the first part now on the neutron scattering, I will focus on the Q dependence at fixed omega, and then in the second part, I will focus on the omega dependence, or energy dependence of the neutron scattering function for a fixed Q value and different Q values. Now that is actually the result, of course, graphically a little bit, made more plastic, to in the AC plane, and you see that instead of that the neutron inelastic scattering develops around the Bragg reflections, which will be somewhere here, one sees a very, very anisotropic development of the fluctuations. That is measured at an energy transfer of 0.1 millielectron volt, and this almost Y-like or quasi one-dimensional feature in K space, of course, would correspond to a two-dimensional feature in real space, and that points to quasi two-dimensional fluctuations that are coupled to 3D quasi-particles. 3D quasi-particles because the electrical resistivity is not very anisotropic in the system. The anisotropy of the electronic resistivity, electrical resistivity is a factor of 2 or something like that. So then we would be just at the upper critical dimension within this Hertz-Miller scenario, and in that scenario we would, as I just mentioned, get these temperature dependencies. So that, of course, would then be roughly in line with our experiment. To show you the actual data that is seen now in this panel, that is the concentration, critical concentration 0.1, and these are the scans for the different values of the A star direction, and I can see actually this Y-shaped feature coming out right here, and I show this data mainly to demonstrate that the same Y-like structure is also observed in the pure serum copper 6. And that is important because it shows that this unusual, very unusual fluctuation spectrum is not due to disorder in the system. It is not due to disorder. It happens also in the pure serum copper 6, and it does, there's some indications also on the other side of the critical concentration of X equals 0.2. Of course, the structures then are somewhat broader, but that is expected because you're going away from the critical concentration. Now, when you look at the energy dependence of the neutron scattering intensity, one really sees a critical slowing down of the magnetic fluctuations when comparing the data for serum copper, pure serum copper 6 with that at the critical concentration. One sees this is serum copper 6, and one sees a very significant shift of the data towards lower energies, and that, of course, demonstrates this critical slowing down. Now, Almuth Schroeder conducted a detailed study of the dynamical scaling of the magnetic fluctuations, and actually she also saw this critical slowing down as she decreased the temperature, and moreover, she looked at different places along this Y-shaped structure and found that the data could actually be scaled with a dynamical imaginary part of the susceptibility being a universal when multiplied with temperature to some power law was a universal function of E over T. And that's written here with an anomalous exponent alpha of 0.75, anomalous because a Lorentzian relaxation would actually give an exponent of 1. So all the data Almuth collected could actually be cast in this simple form where the divergence and the in the energy or temperature dependence was Q independent, and all the Q dependence was associated with a non-critical sort of generalized Q revised temperature feeder. And that actually was then supported by an analysis of the DC susceptibility or DC magnetization, that is the Q equals zero susceptibility that is plotted here as a function of T to this exponent alpha 0.75, and one sees a real very nice straight line up to a temperature of the order of 6 or 7 K. And if she takes the neutron scattering data as measured and calculates the chi of Q via Kramers-Kronig analysis, then also she sees the same temperature dependence. And so that is this intercept then would be the generalized Q revised temperature. I'm sorry, the intercept here down here would be the generalized Q revised temperature. And even for different concentrations, there are some indications that this universal behavior holds. And that, of course, prompted Piers Coleman, Chimia C, Catherine Pepin, and others to suggest a more radical scenario than just this spin density wave scenario. To remind you, the spin density wave scenario assumes that the quantum temperature is actually finite at the quantum phase transition. That is to say that the heavy fermions being actually composite fermions composed of the F electron with its surrounding spin compensation cloud, that these heavy fermions retain their identity when passing through the quantum critical point. That is all that happens as you crank up sort of the magnetic interaction and get to this quantum critical point. You get a the quasi-particles acquire an infinite mass because they are scattered by the spin fluctuations. And this scenario then, however, is not compatible with this n at e over t scaling, and also this independence of Q points to a local effect. And that prompted Katrin Pierce-Coleman, Jimmy R.C. to suggest that there is some energy scale, perhaps the quantum energy scale itself, that goes to zero as one goes to the quantum critical point. So that would be a more radical breakdown of the Fermi-Liquid. And that is actually where we stand. We have to do more experiments and to check whether how to support this scenario. And of course, there's a lot of problems with this scenario as far as theory is concerned, but I'm not a theorist, so I won't speak about that. But 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had a very nice discussion on the issue of integrating out the fermions in this order parameter, generalized order parameter theory of Ginsburg, Landau, Wilson. Now, in order to look at a little bit more into this issue, whether one has a strong change of the Fermi surface, we measure the Hall constant of theorem couple 6. So that is the Hall constant plotted as a function of temperature from room temperature down to, 20, 30 millikelvin. And what one sees is that for all the concentrations around the critical concentration, there's hardly any difference down to about 20 Kelvin. And then things really start to move, and we get a negative, and then a constant thermoelectric, Hall constant for the pure system. And then as we increase the gold concentration, we actually see a very strong change of the Hall constant. And a nice thing is that one sees that below something like 300-400 millikelvin, the Hall constant becomes really constant, that is independent of temperature, indicating that one has actually entered a coherent ground state.
I take it the green curve is just off. It's at zero.
No, that's the concentration, 0.05. It's really, it seems that with this concentration, we have just hit the concentration where one has a change of the Hall constant from negative to positive. We have to do these experiments to higher temperatures, but it looks like zero. Yeah, it is just fun. But that's how the data look. So there is definitely this possibility. Yeah.
Calculate for this compound?
It has, according to Mike Noam, he just told me.
Yeah, it's an incredibly complicated for research.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect the same things in the ytterbium case that if RH goes from zero actually in several locations of the function.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No, but wait a second. If it changes, it means that the bone structure is changing. If the bone structure is not changing, we shouldn't see a change.
For sure.
Okay, I think that's all written down here. So there's the possibility, of course, that we have a whole electron Fermi surface change of the heavy quasiparticles. It's clear that we are, you know, in the system of heavy quasiparticles because nothing happens above the corner temperature. But then there's problems that have to be addressed, namely, how about the anomalous Hall effect that we have to analyze in detail? And also, if you have different Fermi surface sheets contributing to the Hall constant, then of course the scattering rates have to be taken into account, and that is a very important issue. It's even for simple semiconductors, you have to worry about mobilities or scattering rates, and that is something that has to be really thought about. Okay, so a nice thing is that we have actually deliberately, in this case, taken the field along the easy direction. I should mention that this system is almost Ising-like, in that the C direction is the easy direction, and the next direction, the A direction, has a 5 times smaller magnetization at given field, and then again a factor of 2 so for the hard direction, so there's a factor of 10 actually between these and hard directions. And we also measure in 1 Tesla, so that we are always out of the anti-ferromagnetic ordering. So it's really a change in the electronic structure, of course, with these caveats I just mentioned.
By the way, there should be 3 Hall constants for this material.
Yeah, There is actually a very strong anisotropy.
So nothing is finding anything special about the quantum concentration?
I don't think we have touched this upon this issue because we are, first of all, we've applied magnetic field, and secondly, we have measured outside the critical range.
From your previous stuff, how the field... There's been a lot of work in these systems about how the field moves at quantum critical point, right?
Yeah, I come to that. Mm-hmm.
So for this field by 1 Tesla, what
do you guys... Okay, well, that as I mentioned, that is outside the antiferromagnetic region. It's well outside. For x equals 0.2, the critical field is something like 0.3, 0.4 Tesla.
So it's all paramagnetic?
That's what I'm trying to say. It's all paramagnetic. So I just want to avoid this complication of antiferromagnetism in this particular measurement. But no, we actually, of course, do the experiments on smaller fields and see what actually happens. Now, if I just take these data and plot them as a function of concentration, that is the lowest temperature data, we actually see this sort of behavior, and it is clear that we cannot decide between the different scenarios that have been advocated. What we are planning to do is to actually measure the Hall constant as a function of pressure at different pressures, and then see what happens. Whether we can perhaps see some distinctions. But the caveats I mentioned, they of course are also valid in the case of pressure dependence.
So before we said it's so paramagnetic, but now you have points in.
No, I'm yeah. I'm. I should have. Yeah. Right. I should have made quotation marks. That is the region where zero fear the system is antiferromagnetic,
okay,
divided by this critical concentration. Yeah.
So how would you then ever come to these curves down there?
These are not. I never came to these curves. These are curves suggested by Piers Coleman and company.
How did you experimentally assess this region?
Oh, well, I think. Well, I mean, you would have to measure at finely spaced pressures, and you would have to sort of discuss the issue of Fermi surface effects and so on. I mean, the scattering rates and anomalous Hall effect. I think the suggestion is quite clear. I think we have to do more experiments, and perhaps also the theorists could actually if band structure effects could be taken into account, actually sort of make some predictions, for instance, on the size of the stern, or whether it's really R of H is discontinuous or just the derivative singular.
If you're sitting at 1 temp,
mm-hmm,
look at Y versus H, is it linear up to 1 Tesla?
It's a little superlinear.
So it has some resemblance to simplifying
Another point that is actually worth mentioning is how the and that is again some input for theory perhaps is how the magnetic, the ordered magnetic moment evolves as a function of concentration. That's perhaps going back to your question, Rachel. So that is the magnetic moment determined from the neutron scattering as a function of gold concentration, and we see the smooth evolution of the magnetic moment. But one also sees that initially the moment is very small, and that of course is a question how this very small moment can lead in the spin density wave scenario can lead to this very large Fermi surface change. On the other hand, we have heard yesterday by again my Norman that a small change in F count can actually lead to large changes in effective Fermi surface volume or cross sections. And the same, not the same, but a similarly sluggish development of the magnetic moment is also seen when you just analyze the specific heat anomaly at the critical temperature in the simplest fashion you can, that is approximating the jump in the specific heat or the anomaly in the specific heat by just the jump and plotting the reduced jump reduced by the value of a mean field jump as a function of concentration. You also see this. And that, of course, is also an issue, whether that would be compatible with the with theory and Hall effect. Mm-hmm.
This is magnetization. That's determined from this low temperature value of the staggered magnetization. Is that?
That's from the neutron scattering, yes.
I mean, you say it's very small. Isn't that what you expect at a second order phase transition, that it increases?
It is small, but it is. I mentioned that it's small to contrast it with the scenario of a sort of sudden change of the Fermi surface. So it would be very interesting for someone, I mean for us, if someone would actually try to calculate how the size of the magnetic moment evolves from this critical concentration. This is just experimental data. And
is
one,
this to follow TN?
No, no. Well, TN is linearly, varies linearly up to x equals 1. Yeah. Okay, you can draw something like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think in the spin density wave scenario, you would expect something like x to the 2/3 or something like that. So some.
That is
just the moment. So initially very small. So we have here very small moments, but then they require sizable.
Compared to TN, it's much smaller.
Well, I think that.
TN must go to zero.
Yeah.
Just to make a much, I think the scenario by Akim is fine for TN.
It was written on one of the previous two graphs,
yes.
But it's not clear what the moment should do
yes.
in the scenario.
Yes.
So I would then like to put another piece of discussion that is the interplay of concentration and pressure tuning. I mentioned in the beginning that the larger gold atoms actually expand the lattice and thereby cause magnetic order. If that's true, then of course one would expect that when one takes a sample that is ordered, here for instance x equals 0.3, and applies pressure, then the near temperature should go down. And indeed it does. It vanishes at around 8 kilobars. And then when you at this critical pressure, the specific heat, starting from zero pressure, that's this curve here, the green diamonds, and if you go to 8 kilobars, you measure the red diamonds, and they fall exactly on top of the x equals 0.1 sample at ambient pressure. And then if you take half, go half the way towards the critical pressure, that is this curve for x equals 0.2, you need half the pressure, 4 kilobars, the triangles, to actually see, again, this logarithmic behavior. And that is really something surprising. It's very surprising that you see this universality, because it's not just that you see the same log behavior that would be correspond to some sort of the same critical behavior, but the amplitude ratio is also the same in terms of critical phenomena. For me, it's surprising, because in ordinary phase transitions, you don't see that. Usually, amplitude ratios are different.
What about the disorder? The one you drive this pressure, is it much purer than the others?
This one is, of course, the purest. I mean, the resistivity increases strongly when you dope. So actually, thank you for this point. This order doesn't, at least for the specific heat, doesn't play a big role. And then actually, this logarithmic behavior suggests that this two-dimensional fluctuation spectrum is still present under pressure. So what was that, Mike?
We were just discussing, it means that concentration and pressure can be mapped onto one another. And this has been shown to happen in chromium as well.
Yeah,
you can map these two variables on.
Uh-huh. Also for the absolute magnitude, not just the temperature dependence. Okay, then perhaps it's not so surprising. Okay, anyway, it was surprising to me. And now if you take this guy that is critical at ambient pressure and apply 6 kilobars, you actually see that this turns over to a firmer liquid. So we have actually a very nice way to play around with pressure and concentration in the system.
All those points on your phase boundary there, they all have identical specific heat, right?
Yeah.
All those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, identical within 10% or so. And it's even more surprising, we published that 10 years ago, and I didn't bother to bring the view graph. You can play the same with silver doping or palladium doping, and when you go to the same concentration, I mean, to the, not the same concentration here, but to the critical concentration, you again see the same thing.
Away from the critical concentration?
Then that's different.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's
okay. More surprises. I just mentioned that when you apply hydrostatic pressure, then the system actually decreases, the near temperature decreases. And now we actually checked, because we know it's an anisotropic system, we wanted to know what actually happens if you apply stress along the different axes. Now along the B and C axis, you see that actually when you apply uniaxial stress, the transition temperature goes down, and at a sufficiently large strain, you actually do see this logarithmic temperature dependence again for the B axis and the C axis. And when we measure it along the A axis, then at first sight, nothing much happens. But if you blow up the specific heat in this region of the transition, you see that actually the near temperature increases with strain or stress along the A axis. And that was also then later seen in the electrical resistivity. Still, we didn't believe that. So we asked Anna de Visser and his crew to measure the thermal expansion. Using the Ehrenfest relation, we have a negative jump in the specific heat, and therefore we need a positive jump in the thermal expansion to get a negative, that is, to get a suppression of the near temperature with stress. And you can see that we have this positive jump for the B axis, that is this data here, and for the C axis, that's this data here. But for the A axis, we have this negative jump, and so that's all fine. We know that we have measured the right thing. This comes out of the thermal expansion experiments. Now, the surprising effect is, this is for concentration 0.3. When you go to 0.5, then things reverse. That is, now for the A direction, you have a positive jump, here you had a negative jump. And for the B direction, you have a negative jump, here you had a positive jump. And the question is, again, that's something that perhaps should be tried to be discussed in terms of band structure effects. This change of the pressure dependence coincides with a drastic change of the C component of the ordering wave vector Q. I mentioned that the Bragg reflections, magnetic Bragg reflections, actually jump onto the A-axis, so that is shown here as a function of concentration. So that's another issue that has to be addressed by some more refined calculations. Now I come to the question that was also already asked, namely, what about pressure and magnetic field dependence? Here I show you more extended data for the x equals 0.2 sample as a function of pressure, and one sees this again, this logarithmic behavior as a function of temperature for the critical pressures of 4 kilobars. Now, when we measure in magnetic field for the same sample, you see that we actually always get this sort of curved behavior. We never get a straight line, regardless of the field we apply. And we actually also measure in elastic Newton scattering the field dependence of the elastic scattering intensity, and that vanishes for two different temperatures around 0.4 Tesla. So we know we are here in this region of 0.4 Tesla, and we don't see any indication of the logarithmic behavior. In fact, the lines that are drawn here are fits to the standard Mourier three-dimensional spin fluctuation scenario, and also at very low temperatures we see something that is reminiscent of C over T proportion to 1 minus some square temperature dependence. So it seems from these data, although we haven't done the Newton scattering, it seems from these data that a field does something strikingly different from pressure. And we've also seen similar things in the resistivity. I don't want to go through this in detail, but it is also very similar in that we do see this T to the 1.5 behavior that is expected for a dirty system in the spin fluctuation scenario, three-dimensional spin density scenario. This has to be contrasted with the magnetic field dependence that Almuth determined from the susceptibility. Oops, here. From the susceptibility, where she found this is the same data in neutron scattering I showed before. Only before I showed actually the susceptibility or the imaginary part of the susceptibility here, I show the scattering function itself, so the data looks different, but it's actually the same data. And here's the data, the susceptibility as a function of field, and one sees some field temperature scaling that is actually very similar to the energy temperature scaling that is seen in the neutron scattering. So that is something that has to be worked out in detail, how this behavior at the critical concentration is compatible with the apparent turning of the system towards a more three-dimensional behavior in a magnetic field. But I think it is not so unusual that a magnetic field drives the system towards a three-dimensional behavior. I think if you have an anisotropic antiferromagnet, In many cases, at the critical spin-flop field, the system becomes sort of three-dimensional. So these are the summaries, the summary of what I wanted to say about cerium copper 6. We have strongly anisotropic fluctuations that are observed over a large concentration range around the quantum critical point. And in particular, that was already mentioned by Thomas Wojtek, this observation in cerium copper 6 rules out a disorder-induced scenario. The origin of this apparent low dimensionality and also of the change of Q vector and the corresponding change in the temperature dependence of the Neel order as determined from the DTI matrix read here from the thermal expansion and other measurements is unclear. And the only thing I could say, hand waving, perhaps one has a strong anisotropy of the RKPY interaction, but that is really something that has to be worked on, and also I mentioned the effect of magnetic field. As you all know, that this low dimensional scenario has also been suggested for eternal rhodium silicon too, but there we have this difference we discussed already of the specific heat coefficient. And it seems that the the two-dimensional or some low-dimensional fluctuations are essential for the technical point of view to actually be able to obtain this local quantum critical scenario that was advocated by Chmielewski. I should mention that, on the other hand, there are other systems like the serum lanthanum ruthenium to silicon II that was investigated by the French group, Fouquet and others, in detail, and also serum nickel to germanium II indicate a more conventional 3D behavior compatible with the Schwarzschild scenario. I should also mention that actually serum ruthenium to silicon II doped with lanthanum is the only other system where detailed inelastic neutron scattering experiments has been done apart from these uranium systems I'll be talking about. So definitely we need more data, more experiments. We need more neutron scattering data, and of course it would be very nice if one could do inelastic neutron scattering under pressure in order to not have to change the concentration and see how things evolve if you just change with pressure. So there is a lot of information on serum copper gold, but there's also a lot of open questions.
Do you have some information of the temperature dependence on the permeability ratio at the quantum critical point?
We are setting that up. This is experiment, but there are some measurements on the related serum copper silver.
Yes.
That system was investigated by Greg Stewart and his group in Augsburg, and measurements were recently done by Schlegel's group, and that was a PRL that appeared 2 or 3 months ago, where one has some deviation with a sublinear, a divergence of the Gunnison parameter with a sublinear divergence, sublinear in temperature, that would also point to a more unconventional scenario, not to the condensed wave scenario. But we are actually planning to do this experiment on this sample. Matthew?
How large is the magnetic anisotropy?
A factor of 10 between hard and easy axis. Yeah. So it's easy axis is 1, then 1/5, and 1/10. Uh-huh. So let me come to the second system. This uranium copper palladium, and I briefly mentioned that because there were also some talks in the kickoff conference on that system. This is a very strongly disordered system. It has a resistivity of roughly 300 micron centimeters as you approach G equals zero, and it has this phase diagram where you suppress antiferromagnetic order starting from pure uranium copper 5 with increasing palladium concentration. Then apparently there is no magnetic order, although I'll discuss that in a minute, and then there's some spin glass behavior coming up. And there have been interesting suggestions, namely that there is some distribution of quantum temperatures due to disorder, so that would not be a non-thermal liquid behavior in my view, but would just be a superposition of local thermal liquids that then mimics non-thermal liquid behavior, and also anomalous single ion scaling. And this was after the first system where this scaling was found, and as mentioned by Mike yesterday, there's a strong deviation there's a strong difference between the exponent alpha for this system, which is 1/3, compared to serum copper gold, where it's something like 0.75. And so that, of course, raises the question, what actually determines alpha in these materials? This alpha that was determined for uranium copper palladium is actually in agreement with the susceptibility. And there has been the swiftest model around where one has tunneling of ordered regions, and a distribution of tunneling rates, of course, gives a wide density of states and thereby sort of a specific heat coefficient that has a weak temperature dependence. And the problem with that system, or this theory, is, of course, there are two problems, I think. First of all, is there any way to predict Lambda? And perhaps even more importantly, what about the tunneling in the presence of dissipation? Because after all, these ordered regions are in an environment, and that would actually then sort of support.
It's more Ising-like on Heisenberg type system, because that's
I know. I cannot tell because it's been on measurements only in polycrystals. I just want to mention this briefly. So because of this possibility, we just plotted the data, now not linearly, but C over G, also logarithmically versus temperature. Left-hand side is specific heat, right-hand side is the susceptibility. And what one sees is that these lambda value are roughly in agreement from these data. And also that when you are, this is for, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that. That is for x equals 1 up to 1.5. So this 1.25 is actually right in the middle, that is furthest away from these magnetically ordered regions. And therefore, it's perhaps not surprising that for this 1.5, you see the largest lambda, which of course means that you're furthest away from the instability, and a largest lambda would actually point towards the direction of a thermal liquid for which you would expect lambda equals 1. But then at low temperatures, of course, one does see strong deviations in the specific heat and in the susceptibility, and these are due to what we believe is thin glass behavior, a strong field dependence of the a very strong field dependence of the specific heat, and also a splitting of the susceptibility between zero field and field-cooled susceptibility, and also between the DC susceptibility and AC susceptibility measured in a frequency range of 100 hertz or so. So I think that is an important issue, and we even try to sort of find some indications of the nonlinear susceptibility, but our measurements were at too large fields to actually extract something. But the data are certainly compatible with such a divergence of the nonlinear susceptibility. So that's the question mark. Okay. I don't go away.
So I have a question, maybe also for Peter Jung. I don't know whether the quantum critical spin glass has been studied. What happens? Does it have an effect when the spin glass transition goes to zero and the quantum critical fluctuations above zero temperature spin glass transition? Has it been studied?
I remember this. There's this nice table of. In Sachdev's book, where he also talks about spin glass critical points. But that is all I remember. I don't remember any detailed calculation. But I would assume if you would be able to suppress the spin glass temperature to zero, then something interesting might be happening. Here it is just the opposite. We have this sort of anomalous non-thermal liquid behavior, but that is actually killed by the spin glass transition at a finite temperature.
On the right side, you have also a fixed point for this.
Yeah, but it's.
So maybe it dominates the.
No, my point was that actually, I'm sorry, here we have spin glass, and here we also have spin glass behavior at finer temperature. So maybe, I mean, I agree that maybe one must measure very, very finely spaced points here, and we would perhaps be able to find that. But the system is rather dirty, so we didn't find.
Maybe you could have a quantum critical regime which is quite big around this T40. I don't know, it's just a, maybe someone knows that it's a silly question. I don't know.
No, I think it's a certainly a valid question, but I think the problem is, I mean, you could also always say this is a whole quantum critical region. Maybe it has to do with some Griffith singularities or something, but then the disorder is not very well controlled in the system. You have what looks like a stoichiometric system. Copper 4 palladium is actually a site interchange system. And the site interchange, the amount of site interchange change depends very, very severely on the way the samples are prepared. So it's not so easy to do these experiments on the system. I mean, it's easy to do the experiments, but it's not easy to control the disorder.
Another question, the
anti-magnetic
phase,
it's
commensurate, or
what is it? I think it is commensurate, but I mean, this has been... I think this was investigated in detail by Keith McEwen. Okay, let me come to this, to the last... part of my talk, maybe 10 minutes or so, if you let me. So this is now switching gears, going to weak itinerant ferromagnet with a rather high transition temperature, and it has a sizable magnetic moment, so it's not a really very weak itinerant ferromagnet. It's actually not a ferromagnet either, because due to this structure, it has no inversion symmetry. So the spin orbit coupling leads to helical twist of the magnetization. So if you look at neighboring spins, it looks like a ferromagnet, but if you look 175 angstroms away, then of course the whole thing has changed by 2 pi, the orientation of the magnetization. And therefore, one observes magnetic superlattice reflections very close to Bragg peaks at ambient pressure. And because of the crystal field and the transitions the spirals lock in at the one in the 111 and equivalent directions. Oops. So there are some characteristic energy scales in the system. We have the nearest neighbor energy ferromagnetic exchange, then the ferrospin orbit coupling leading through this long wavelength spiral, and then finally this crystal field potential that locks the helix into 111 direction. Let me skip this. What Christian Pleiderer found a number of years ago when he was still in Cambridge, that when you apply hydrostatic pressure, the Curie temperature drops first linearly and then a little bit faster and vanishes around 15 or so kilobars, 14.6 kilobars. And above a pressure P star of 12 kilobars, the order of the transition becomes first order. And that he inferred from the susceptibility, which is shown in this right-hand panel, where at 12 kilobars, the susceptibility as a function of temperature at the transition actually exhibits a jump. When you measure the resistivity, or when Christian Pleiderer measured the resistivity, then he found that below the temperature, below the transition temperature, that's ambient pressure, the resistivity varies with T-square behavior. And as one decreases, increase the pressure, decrease the Curie temperature, of course, this T-square law becomes visible only in a smaller and smaller range. But it is seen at lowest temperature right up to the critical pressure. And then at the critical pressure of 14 or so kilobars, the power of the resistivity jumps to 1.5. And again, that is seen above the critical pressure over a large pressure range. And it is rather insensitive to pressure and insensitive also to the residual resistivity. So that has been determined on different samples. And that is just the plot to convince you that that is really seen over large temperature range from something like 20 or so millikelvin up to something like 15 or so kelvin.
What is the temperatures? There is some kind of deviation from this T1.5.
This one here?
Yes. Well, there is no
evidence. Since I didn't take the data, it's hard for me to tell, but I certainly, Well, it's within, almost within scatter, yeah.
What is the temperature dependence if you go to smaller versions than the critical one, but above the transition temperature? So let's say you go to 13 kilobar and what is above TC.
It looks, I think it was visible on the previous graph.
That's why I'm asking.
Yeah, yeah. It looks as if, definitely it's not T square law, but it's something like T to 1.5 or something. Mm-hmm.
It could be that even extends to the left of the critical pressure.
Yeah, above the, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, the idea was to do a neutron scattering under pressure to actually see what happens to the spiral. And it's a complicated story. So this is now the intensity elastic neutron scattering as a function of temperature. If you now look and that is for roughly for the Q vector corresponding to the length of the spiral, periodicity of the spiral. If you look at the 111 direction, that is where the spiral actually was located, or the direction of the spiral was located for ambient pressure, you just see a very small signal. You also see hysteretic signal. That's not surprising, because I showed you that we do have a first order transition close to the critical pressure, that's 14 kilobars. But then if you go away from this former direction of the spiral in the 111 direction, you actually see a huge signal. And also, you don't see an onset, a sudden onset of the signal, but sort of a sluggish increase. And if you take all the intensity, that is associated with this direction, other direction, I'll come to that, the total scattering intensity is the same as it was for ambient pressure. That is, no intensity is lost, so to speak. No moments are lost in loose terminology. Now, what Christian Fleider and Lothar Penchovius then did was, let me just go back to this picture here. That was the original, at peak with zero, the original direction of the spiral. Now, what they did, they cut through this radius with through this sphere with radius that corresponds to this spiral length in that direction, and also in that direction. So that is transverse and longitudinal and transverse. So that's the longitudinal scan that is actually cutting through this sphere, and one sees that the signal is actually resolution. The width of the signal is resolution limited. That is, the long range order is retained along the helical direction. On the other hand, measuring transverse, one sees a much broader structure or scattering than the resolution. So that suggests that one has a wide angular distribution of the helical direction. The helix retains its length, but it's now moving all over the place, all over the directions. And that is written here again, and also sort of discussed in a cartoon-like fashion. That is the reflections at ambient pressure, and that is around this region here, where one sees sort of a diffuse, no sharp break, super lattice reflection, but sort of diffuse scattering intensity all over this sphere with a radius given by the periodicity of the spiral. So that led us to suggest that we have some new type of order. We call that partial order because, as I mentioned, the propagation direction of the spiral are distributed over wide angular range. And there is, of course, the question, is this really static or dynamic, because we measure only with an energy resolution of 50 micro electron volts. But then this partial order has also been seen in NMR experiments, which, of course, measure at a much much longer length scales. And so although this issue is open, there is some indication that the structure might be dynamic. And this leads us to the question, of course, how does this long-range order actually melt? And that is where now we have just, you know, plotted from textbooks these different partial orders that are observed in liquid crystals. In our case, it could be that the pinning of the helix is lost either by domain walls or by a proliferation of topological defects. And as an example of such a topological defect, I show you here a calculation by Alex Boganov, who was in our institute. He's in Dresden, but he was in our institute for a couple of months. And that is actually one of these magnetic vortices where the direction changes from downward in the inside to upward in the outside. And if you look at this closely, and perhaps in a slightly different fashion, you could imagine that this then perhaps is a vortex that might be proliferated by this particular structure, because also when you think of domain walls, domain wall of course is something that is changing its orientation, where the spins are changing their orientation. Usually domain walls always have a positive energy that is always necessary to it's always necessary to have some energy to create a domain dipole. And that is actually, the energy is gained by the dipolar field outside. But for the sample itself, you have always a positive energy. Now, it could be because the spiral structure actually is something like a domain wall that you might have, in this particular case, sort of a negative domain wall energy, and then this would look almost like a type 2 superconductor in a loose analogy, where you also have a negative domain wall energy between normal conducting and superconducting regions. So I think there's a lot of interesting ideas around. Let me skip the magnetic field dependence, and let me come to this last point. What is the analogy between cerium copper gold, manganese silicide, and these objects here? And I think there's perhaps a superficial analogy. At a quantum phase transition, the temperature is the only relevant, or at least the dominant, energy scale. And something like that also happens in these materials. So I think there is perhaps some analogy. And let me make two more remarks. They are also very speculative. First of all, when you just look at the entropy emerging from a quantum critical point, if you have this divergence of
the specific heat coefficient,
then of course,
I'm sorry, this logarithm is
missing right here. Then the entropy should be given by some function like that. And also in this ytterbium rhodium to silicon to stuff, there actually also the entropy is much larger initially in these cases than for from a liquid. Of course, the entropy has to go to zero at t equals zero, but here you have an extra sort of a lot of entropy that has to be removed to get to t equals zero. And so I would speculate that there's an increasing relative importance of the entropy as you go to temperature equals zero. I don't know if that is of any relevance, but that's actually something that occurred to me. And then there's the other point is that actually, when you look closer at this analogy between the ordering that occurred in the chiral ferromagnet, that is in manganese silicide, and if you look at crystalline liquids or liquid crystals, the blue phases, there's this nice article by Merman and Wright, where I took all these quotations from. These blue phases are actually frustrated defect phases in chiral liquid crystals, and they develop in a small temperature range between the isotropic liquid and the cholesteric phase. And there are actually several phases of several types of blue phases, so-called blue phases 1 and 2, that are crystals that have lattice constants compared to the wavelength of the visible light. So you actually see nice sort of different Bragg reflections in different colors, and the diffraction pattern corresponds to crystallites with helical order of different but well-defined directions. But there's one phase, so that would not be the same as we see in manganese silicide, but there's one phase called Wu-Fog phase, which has an amorphous-like diffraction pattern. And that, in analogy, would suggest that the chirality in this blue phase is actually pointing in all different directions. I found another remarkable statement that the optimization of blue phase stability is only possible at higher dimensions. So actually, Wright and Merman do the analogy between this blue phase stability and the problem of tiling of pentagons in the plane, where you have to actually go to higher dimensional curved space to actually get a optimization of tiling of pentagons. And furthermore, they actually discussed chiral ferromagnets and did some Ginsberg-Llano analysis, and they suggested that blue phases are not stable in chiral ferromagnets. And this is the only sentence that is actually that I have written on this, and that's my speculation. If that is indeed true, does this extra time dimension, the quantum phase transition, provide some extra stability? And then I thought this was also a very nice statement. The puzzle of the blue phases and the apparent solution has been found in a more thoughtful application of existing theories rather than through the introduction of radically new ideas. But that's, of course, David Merman. So let me conclude. I think the issue at heart is really how does a metallic solid melt at a quantum critical point? Is there some sort of general breakup of three-dimensionality, and what determines whether a given system does exhibit this lower dimensional behavior and others do not? What happens to the Fermi surface? And something I didn't address, but that seems to be an important issue in interacting with silicon too, there seems to be some disparity between transport and thermodynamic. And then I discussed the possibility of new phases at the magnetic quantum critical point, this new partial order in manganese silicide, and the issue is that really related to anomalous non-Fermi liquid behavior. There are some calculations by Achenbosch that suggest that domain walls do not lead to this T to the 3 half law, but would give a different power law. Uranium, copper, palladium, I discussed a little bit, and I would like to quote Thomas Reuter, who a few weeks ago asked the question, what is actually a robust feature of disordered quantum critical point? And I think that is really a very important point. So it would be nice to have a system where one controls the disorder and one knows what disorder does. And then finally, my speculative part, can one draw formal analogies between hard matter near quantum phase transition and soft matter? What about HBAR? And thank you.
Audience reached a stage of exhaustion, or there's some questions?
I'm sorry, went slightly over time.
No, it's fine.
How far to the, in manganese silicide, how far to the left of the critical pressure would I be able to find the T to the 3 half if I go so high above the transition? Is this known, or is it found all the way to ambient pressure?
That's not known to me. I mean, one would have to take a look at the data, but I can't tell you offhand. I'm pretty sure the data exists at high temperatures, but I can't tell you.
What's actually happening to the film series? Somehow. Why did you put this?
Have you been paying attention?
Yeah, you should calculate it.
That's the first part, didn't you know?
You mentioned there's a luminous Hall effect.
No, I just mentioned we have to analyze the data and look at who's gathering things like that because for residual moments in order to find that. Because the anomalous Hall effect is given by essentially the product of the resistivity and the susceptibility. The susceptibility doesn't change that much when one goes across the concentration, but the resistivity does. So that is something we have to look for. And look at in detail.
My question is: the luminous Hall effect relates to ferromagnetism.
But if you have local magnetic moments, you can also have localized magnetic moments. You have school scattering.
Even the localized moment of order
antiferromagnetism. Yeah. Even if the localized moments are there without ordering, you can have this anomalous Hall effect.
They don't cancel out
on the average? No. As far as I know the literature, they don't.
As long as you have localized movement, it doesn't matter if they're working or not.
I mean, of course, there will be an influence of the order on the Hall effect. But the anomalous Hall effect, as such, is existing also in non-ordered systems containing magnetic moments.
In uranium, copper, palladium, these presumed lambda exponent in that region between the antiferromagnetic and the spin class, it didn't change much, right?
It didn't, yeah.
Always around 0.7.
Yeah.
Would it be a possibility to drive uranium, copper, palladium under pressure to see whether this is
on? Yeah, we tried, but there's a tiny change with pressure. Very ever so tiny.
So what is it? Compared to the behavior of
resulting? No, there's no pressure effect. I mean, the near temperature for the pure uranium copper palladium, for the pure uranium copper 5, the near temperature is hardly affected.
I see.
So So and then we didn't try to sort of go closer. Mm-hmm.
So it means that the substitution of copper is just not a steric effect.
Oh, definitely not. No, but you wouldn't expect that because copper and palladium have different electronics,
yeah.
Different number of electrons.
Small value and then jumps to a big value. So I think this here first of all transition there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this case here you have a continuous evolution of the ordered moment. That's what we see.
I think the moment in turbine ordering to silicon tree has not been determined from Lutyens scattering. What was determined was the effective moment.
Yeah.
From the susceptibility. So in our case, also the effective moment in the cerium copper gold is rather large, but you have this strong offset. So meaning that you have a rather large negative Curie-Weiss theta, and that is actually why the susceptibility as a whole is much smaller. Okay.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.